Next case on our calendar is 97630, State of Ohio, X-Rail Service Employees International Union versus State Employment Employee Relations Board. Mr. Newman.
Thank you. The evidence before served probable cause, direct evidence, was uncontradicted, and was substantial evidence. Both the value of this evidence and the weight of it were far greater than the evidence before the board in the Adena case, which later reached this court. There are four sources of evidence in the record before served. First of all, there was the general counsel of the University of Cincinnati acknowledging flat out that one of the reasons for the privatization was for the hospital to be free of state labor regulations. Secondly, the other counsel acknowledged that being free of the state labor regulations meant that the University Hospital Inc. Should be free of the doctors' union, the house staff union, who under federal law are students, but are considered employees under state law by virtue of the opinion in this court in University Hospital versus Serve for hearing at 63 Ohio State. Thirdly, the evidence was that the university said being free of state labor regulations permitted the administrator of University Hospital Inc. To eliminate the property rights that nurses have, and also they regarded being in the federal arena as being more favorable conditions in dealing with labor unions.
That's all in your brief, and we've read that, Counselor. I'd like to know just a practical question. If we find a ULP here, or certainly one that should be investigated, because the investigator for CERB found there to be a probable cause for ULP, what's the practical effect?
The practical effect is that if CERB rules in our favor and finds that there was not a labor practice charge, that they should order the reinstatement of all these employees to the University of Cincinnati. Then if the University Hospital Inc. wants to retain their services, they can be leased out as employees, as the management employees are.
You mean the employees would go back and be employees of the University of Cincinnati?
And state employees, yes.
And state employees.
Correct.
Would there be a transfer back of what amounts to title and interest in the properties to this university?
There would not be.
So you would have public employees working for a private entity?
That's correct. That would be the appropriate remedy.
Well, that's what it was in Ohio Historical Society, too.
Yes. The evidence, if I may, in terms of this topic, was numerous, it was substantial, and clearly there was anti-union animus in evidence against the university when they say they want to get rid of the compulsory arbitration of nurses, and when they say, as they did, that by separating out hospital employees, it will make it more likely that they can bargain acceptable benefit levels for the other unions. This is the divide and conquer strategy of the university.
Well, it's not anti-union as such, is it? It's anti-public employees union, I guess, or the benefits that come from being a public employee in a bargaining unit.
Anti-union, I'm so specifically directed against the public employee union, yes.
Counsel, you alluded to some information or evidence. When you read the opposing counsel's brief, they talk about this being a small fraction of volumes and volumes of other evidence as to why this was a wise move. Are you suggesting that the fashion of proposition of law or find a ULP when there is overwhelming evidence, let's just assume for argument's sake, there's overwhelming evidence on the business side that this is a good move. Is the union issue alone enough that you should stop what is a good business move for the organization?
What I believe the state of the law is that you're governed by the PARC test, and this is not inconsequential evidence of anti-union animus in And I might say by contrast, it is overwhelmingly more than was before the CERB board in the Indiana case, where they found and made a final determination of an unfair labor practice charge, where there was a teacher who was not renewed, who had filed a grievance, who had a good record. That was all the evidence there was. They made
right,
a final determination of an unfair labor practice.
She was fired. I made a distinction there where here they people still have their same jobs, they still have union rights, they have changed, you know, their structure a little bit because they no longer are state public employees. But I hear what you're saying is that if there's a union animus, that can squelch what could be a sound business practice or a sound business reason. And doesn't that ultimately hurt all of Ohio and all of the employees of Ohio?
Well, I don't think the union animus can be regarded as de minimis in this case, or the evidence de minimis in this case. Substantial anti-union expressed in the record. With respect to the consequences also are not nominal. These employees, they have to give up their pension, right, so state pension, which are much more valuable than they might be able to obtain privately. Secondly, the doctors have had to shed themselves of their union altogether. They're not going to be recognized in the federal world. They have no rights to collect for the bar. The nurses have lost substantial substantive rights in the workplace to have their contracts.
Well, you're not answering my question. My question is that enough to squelch a sound business? So that's the question. Not that there wasn't enough evidence that there was union animus. Let's even concede there was union animus. Are you proposing that union animus is sufficient to squelch a business deal?
Yes, absolutely.
I just want to get a good handle on what your parameters are, and you're basically saying in part can kill everything.
Well, privatization is fine, and it's legal, and it can happen. But it cannot happen when a part of the reason for doing it is to shed the public employer of the unions and to shed the entity that's going to succeed to this public asset of the unions.
Can you see that?
That's a circumstance where it is illegal.
Can you see any circumstance then where any agency in Ohio, any entity in Ohio that has public employees could then go private? Can you give me a scenario in which you think they could?
Yes, I can. One of the reasons is not simply to get rid of a doctor's union or to get rid of the unions or to minimize the efforts. It must be neutral with respect to the labor relations. If there is a factor involved in the decision that meets the Adena in part test, then it cannot be done.
I wonder if we can agree first on what I think is the primary issue in these sort of cases, and that is the start with the standard review, which is it seems that the parties are not in agreement even about what this court's standard is.
I'm in agreement with you.
Abuse of discretion, not substantial evidence.
Yes.
Okay. Abuse of discretion.
Yes.
And that's where we start. Which, you know, we can really get to a lot of the injury and the factual and, you know, Bruce Dark John, but we're really to a very high standard. And it's equivalent to a prosecutor, as I understand it, the decision by a prosecutor to decide whether or not they have, in this case, it's required that the board find that they can prove by clear and convincing evidence whether or not they have enough probable cause, knowing that the standard is clear and convincing. So I wonder if you'd address that for us, how we show an abuse of discretion.
Sure. Number one, the investigator recommended defining the probable cause. That's a factor. Other indicia of arbitrariness is that there were four items of evidence before the board. They just totally disregarded three of them. And with respect to the anti-union animus expressed towards the doctor's union, the house staff, they just disbelieved the university. They've just taken at its word. The board said it's not possible that the privatization would have been engineered simply to get rid of the doctor's union, when the university said that one of the reasons for doing it was simply that. I mean, and there's no evidence in the record challenging the credibility of that evidence. That is arbitrary. In addition, I think another factor is simply the weight of the evidence involved here, the cumulative nature of it, that compares to the evidence that was observed in Amina, that the,
I want to go back to the procedural matter for a minute because I'm really struggling with that for purposes of ultimate decision in this case. You don't cite it, I guess nobody does, but we had the Ohio Historical Society case where it ended up being the Ohio Historical Society, which is a private not-for-profit corporation, albeit organized by the General Assembly pursuant to statute, had in effect refused to collectively bargain. There was no question that the public that the employees were public employees for purposes of PERS and all the other indicia that we would normally look at. The decision of that case came out that in fact it was a private employer, albeit that the employees were public. Therefore, there would not have to be any collective bargaining because it was not a public employer. You answered my question here that if we reverse or find a ULP, it goes back, the employees are then become employees of the University of Cincinnati, but would still not, would they not, have to bargain with the private employer. I guess the bottom line is, can you accomplish what you're trying to accomplish without reversing the entire procedure of privatization?
Well, there are employers, they're going to be reinstated to their former employers, and they're going to bargain with their former employers. If the University of Cincinnati wants to loan these employees to the private entities, they may do so, and there is already a precedent for doing that, as they've done with their management employees.
So they would bargain with the
University of
Cincinnati Board of Directors or Human Resources Director as opposed to the
Correct.
Private entity?
Yes, sir.
Isn't that creating a fiction in the law?
A fiction in the law? I think it preserves the integrity of the labor statute, 4117.
It's specifically what, 08A?
Yes. I'd like to just comment. Yes, sir.
Well, I'm concerned about the same question, I guess, that Justice Cook raised, and that is our standard review and the abuse of discretion here. We've said, of course, in State Sir versus Miami University and other cases that we defer to Sir because it's the expert, and I think the employee won in that case. I'd like your response to all of the evidence that's submitted that. Or statements submitted that the university, the hospital was having problems financially with all the managed care and all the reasons they gave. It's a teaching hospital. They projected a $4 million deficit in 1997. Doesn't that argues against arbitrariness, I guess, does it not? Or unconscionability that they were struggling to cut cost, and this was one of the ways in which they did it?
Your Honor, the record at this stage is simply that both sides have submitted evidence in support of their contentions to serve in order for serve to make the initial finding. We do not agree with much of their evidence with respect to the need for privatization and the urgency for it, and specifically this $4 million projected operating deficit. But it was not an actual
projected
bottom line deficit. So when we have a full hearing before CIR, a lot of these facts are going to be indeed hotly contested. Disagree with several at this one. I would like, if I may, just make one comment about one of the arguments that my opposition is going to be making, and that is that it cannot be a violation of 4117 when an employer takes action to when they go to protections under federal law, if they trade their union status under state law to federal law. There is no bait and switch justification for a violation of 4117. It's an unfair labor practice, according to that statute, to interfere with the exercise of the rights guaranteed by Chapter 4117. The rights under 4117 are different in content than those under federal law. If one chooses to be a member of a labor union under state law, one has a right to the continuation of those benefits, and it is not a justification for an interference of those rights that one simply can become a member of a union that's protected by a different jurisdiction.
And of course, but if you follow that argument, then you're saying, in my previous question, you can never privatize. Because any time you privatize, you will interfere with those rights.
May I respond?
Sure.
If the purpose, one of the purposes is of the privatization is to strip somebody of their protections under 4117, that privatization is tainted and in a violation of 4117 and it can't be justified by the ability of some employees, not necessarily all of them, to pick up some rights under the labor laws of a different jurisdiction.
Well, I'll give you 30 seconds. Thank you, Mr. Newman. Mr. Jones.
May it please the Court, I'm Daniel Jones from the Office of the Ohio Attorney General, representing the State Department of Justice.
Watch your time there so that you leave time for him.
Counsel, what sort of pension rights were cut? What did they have under the old plan versus the new plan? I'm assuming it's PERS.
Under the old plan, Your Honor, they were under the PERS. I frankly do not know and do not consider what the new pension benefits are. But the effects of the privatization were, in fact, bargained with all the unions concerned beginning in July of 1996. This transaction happened nearly a year ago. Everybody is under it. I think that Justice Douglas' question is the primary question for the court. What do we do as a practical matter? How do we unwind what happened a year ago and go back and pretend it didn't happen? One of the issues...
Well, how do we ignore labor animus as a, or age animus. I was reading the comments here, one of the doctors ran the hospital said, you know, it's isn't right, these older nurses can bump these young nurses. Should we just ignore all of that because lots happened? Is that going to be the rule?
Well, there are a couple answers to that, Justice Pfeiffer. One of those is that the memo being bandied about here is in the context of should we propose legislation that would change the way Chapter 4117 operates as for hospitals. And some of these ideas about bumping rights and that sort of thing came out of that memo in 1995. That was not before the trustees when they made the decision that yes, indeed, we will privatize. The bigger issue here, I believe, is the one that the Chief Justice has raised. Isn't this anti-regulation? Not necessarily anti-union, but choosing your form. We're dealing here with reasons as opposed to consequences. The reasons for privatizing are well documented in the
But aren't some of those reasons to avoid competitive bidding, prevailing wage, and the troublesome nurses' union?
Yes. Those are not reasons. The reason for privatizing...
You're saying those are not reasons for privatizing? I read in the record that those were some of the things, some of the benefits of privatization.
Yes. Justice Resnick, the record reflects that the entire decision was based on the managed care issue. This is a hospital that cannot compete under managed care because of their ties to the state. And a lot of the effects on being a state entity are outlined within the record. and that was a consequence. But there were also disadvantages. One of the disadvantages that was pointed out, for example, is we now have to get malpractice insurance for our doctors. We're not under immunity, and that is a disadvantage. So all these things were weighed, but the overwhelming factor was we have to compete in this new market.
Wait a minute, I guess I didn't understand that one. There's immunity for any doctor who practices in a university hospital.
At least state employees would have immunity.
You have to go to court of claims. You have to go to court of claims.
Right.
It's not really immunity. It's a different form in which recovery is sought.
Right. Well, they would be under the court of claims system, and they would no longer have that protection once they became private.
It's not all doctors in practice. It's just employee doctors.
Yes, the state employees. That's correct.
Counselor, the under the federal law and under our Adena case, the in part test is what we're bound by. And here, there certainly is memoranda indicating that the union problem, in quotes, was one of the reasons certainly to privatize. Given the case law in this area, would not we have to overrule Adena in order to affirm? Or to deny the writ?
No, Justice Douglas, I don't believe you do. Adena is just a case for several reasons. One is, as has been pointed out by the court, I believe Justice Stratton, there's been no discharge here. These employees went to new employment, at least they were offered new employment, as opposed to the Adena situation. Another is that this was not brought up as a discrimination charge before CERB. This was brought up as an interference charge, which is different. In any case, went to the discrimination issues. Now, there is a pending charge at CERB, which is in state pending decision on discrimination.
Wait a minute. Because if you're right, if discharge is the only criteria pursuant to Adena, then we're in a different ballgame. But Adena says, in part, the proponent of the change has the initial burden of showing that the action by the employer was taken to discriminate against the employee for the exercise of rights protected by 4117. That doesn't say anything about discharge.
Well, it's a discrimination, Your Honor. What happened here is that everybody in the hospital, all employees, managers, non-union employees, union employees, all were subjected to this change. Union employees were not singled out and discriminated against as an Adena type employee is. You can single out because you exercise rights.
So if we discriminate against everybody, it's okay, just so long as we don't single out some people.
Well, that goes to the question that was raised about the business justification against Justice Stratton raised. I don't believe that you can fashion a rule in this case, because any time an employer that's a public employer decides it's in our best interest as a business matter to go ahead and privatize, some public employee may lose his or her human rights. And if the rule of law is, if you're going to lose human rights due to privatization, you can't do it. Nobody will ever do it. That's the practical consequence of this. And you can never do it because a public employee will lose his public employment union rights as opposed to federal rights. We also have a preemption issue as a practical matter in this case. The unions, at least four of them, are already under federal jurisdiction. We have one union that's disappeared. I know the court's got the briefs on that, but they no longer exist. And that would be the residents' union. Mr. Chief Justice, I reserve some time.
Your light's not on, so you have at least 2 minutes left.
All right. Are there any other questions before I take my seat?
Thank you, Mr. Jones.
Thank you.
Mr. Rogers.
Justice Douglas, I would like to address one point that you brought up regarding the Ohio Historical Society case. It's been some time since I've read that case. But I believe that a large part of the rationale for that decision was based upon National Labor Relations Board policy and then Reg Care at the time, which was dealt with circumstances under when the Federal Labor Board would take jurisdiction over a union and when it would not. 2 years ago, the Management Training Council, or perhaps it was just last year, the Management Training Council the board reversed that longstanding doctrine. So I think a large part of the underpinning for Ohio Historical Society has been removed. And I suggest that if that case would come to you afresh today, that perhaps the decision in that case might be different.
So did they take cognizance under the Federal Labor Relations Act?
Yes, they do.
Of the Ohio Historical Society?
I do not know whether the Ohio Historical Society has petitioned the Labor Board for recognition, but under the way that the Labor Board policy is today, the NLRB would assert jurisdiction under certain circumstances. So that's a fundamental difference.
So the change in policy was removing the conflict that if it's denied federal jurisdiction, it automatically became state jurisdiction?
The way it was,
or at least arguably.
The way it was, they were left in a limbo, which were neither subject to state jurisdiction nor federal jurisdiction. And certainly that was a concern that this court had in Ohio Historical Society. And that limbo has been removed. I would like to point out another thing that Mr. Newman brought up. He said that the management employees have been left as employees of the university. That's not what the record reflects. The record reflects that the university had 3,300 employees, and that those employees all went through the employment of the Health Alliance to University Hospital Ames, and no one was singled out here. That all employees, union and non-union alike, became employees of the Health Alliance. The pensions, they did not lose whatever pension rights they had, under PERS.
Yeah, but those pension rights would become incredibly valuable because the key to the whole state pension system is length of service.
See, the new system recognized that people had length of service and recognized the time value of service, and the new systems that were negotiated with the employees could be tripping after that fact, so people would not be left holding that. Indeed, all four unions reached almost immediate agreement with the new hospital, and the AFSCME agreement apparently is favorable enough. They did not choose to participate in this proceeding. Only four of the five unions at the old hospital signed on to this proceeding, and one of those, the house deputy, is now gone. So you only have three of the original five pursuing this petition in this court.
It was gone because you dissolved it.
No, they chose to dissolve it, Your Honor.
Well, they aren't recognized under the federal law, so they couldn't exist. Isn't that right?
They are students under federal law, not employees, and whether or not they chose to exist in that context, that is what they're doing, Your Honor. With respect to the memo brought up by Dr. Harrison, I believe that you referenced, Justice Stratton, I guess it was you, Justice Piper. Dr. Harrison did not make the decision here. The Cincinnati Board of the University, the Cincinnati Board of Trustees makes this decision. It's their motivation that is in the issue here. And we respectfully submit that there's no evidence that the University of Cincinnati Board of Trustees was motivated by anti-union animus.
He was the person in charge of the system. Leading up to
Vice President and Provost for Medical Affairs.
Okay, so one would reasonably assume that his thoughts and recommendations or discussion of problems as the system presently existed would play a large role in any decision that a part-time board would make.
Well, there's no evidence in the record that the Board of Trustees had before this memo. There is no evidence that the Board of Trustees was motivated by any anti-union animus. The only evidence in the record is that the Board of Trustees were motivated by the same consideration that state universities in Oregon and Colorado and West Virginia and Florida and Indiana, Boston are going through the same thing now. Every state, but many, many states are facing the same problem. That is how their hospitals, which have a higher cost structure because of state regulations, because of the academic medical component, which drives up their costs, how do they compete in a system, at least in Ohio, in which where we have these extra costs, but the state doesn't give us any subsidy to pay for these extra costs? How do we compete both within the Health Alliance of Greater Cincinnati for business, and how do we compete outside of Health Alliance of Greater Cincinnati for the entire community?
This is really not directly related to the legal issues in front of us, but it's important when we look at the overall consideration that a valuable asset was handed off to this corporation. It was a very valuable asset. If it were to have been sold, it would have required a deed from the legislature, would it not?
The form of the transaction would have to be different than the form of the
transaction. Yeah. So by doing a long-term lease, that avoided any legislative oversight of this decision.
Well, Mr. Rubin and the city of Cincinnati, who was representing different parties in that case, and the city of Cincinnati challenged the authority of the University of Cincinnati to do this very transaction. And the court found the city of Cincinnati to find the issue a temporary restraining order that's allowed.
But my question is, you didn't have to go to the legislature to get approval to hand off this asset, and you would have if it had been a sale.
Under 140 of the Ohio Revised Code, you maintain the court of competence upheld to get the power to sue for it without having to go to the legislature. The legislature would seek permission. That is correct. Ultimately, what the relators are doing is seeking to challenge the wisdom of CERB in setting labor policy distinction, as this court has said time and time again. CERB is the expert body that's designated by the General Assembly to set the labor policy in the state. CERB had before the same evidence that's been brought before you, and CERB made it a decision after looking at all the evidence not to go forward with the charge. We submit that it did not abuse its discretion. This court has defined the term.
What's the best evidence of the non-arbitrariness decision? That's the argument on the other side that it's arbitrary and that this investigator came forward with a recommendation that there was probable cause. What's the best show of good support?
Your Honor, the University of Cincinnati Hospital was part of a six-hospital alliance that lived, part of a six-hospital alliance. It had to compete with five other private hospitals just within the alliance.
Business reasons.
Well, this area is Your Honor. Absolutely. And it had to bring its cost structure in line and be able to operate within that alliance on the same terms as the other partners in that alliance, or else it's not going to get the business and ultimately be forced to go out of business.
There's a finding that there should be a hearing on the ULP charge. Necessarily mandate that a ULP will be found?
I will not.
Okay. So that really haven't they just at this point asked for a hearing, and could not the economic interests that have been argued back and forth or discussed back and forth could then be asserted in opposition to the finding of ULP, and thereby, on balance, rule there was no ULP? In other words, can the economics be balanced against the in part test?
Well, that can't be balanced. The court ruled the way it did in Medina. I submit that there is no evidence here of anti-union animus. The CERB had.
Supposing we found some, that internal memorandum that, in addition to everything else, says while privatization will not remove unions, it will permit them and the administration to operate under more favorable conditions with the NLRB than is presently possible with CERB. And you're familiar with all those internal memorandums, probably painfully familiar with some of them.
But
it's there. So let's just assume for a moment that it is there. Can there be a balancing given Adina?
Two answers. One, I think that there has to be. Two, that particular memorandum, again, addresses a proposal to go to Ohio State, to go to Medical College at Toledo, and seek a legislative solution to the problems foreseen at the university and hospital. That the proposal attracted no interest, and it died. The university doesn't control, the doesn't manage university hospital, and hasn't managed it ever since the advent of the health alliance. So there was that memo talks about the university continuing to have contracts. Under the present structure, the university doesn't have any contracts. The health alliance, the university hospital incorporated, past these contracts will be. We're not seeing, the university doesn't bargain with these unions with respect to employees in the hospital. Most of these unions represent other people at the university and other jobs, and we bargain with those and have agreements with those.
If you know, has there been a subsequent collective bargaining engaged in between AFSCME, who strangely is not part of this, AFSCME and the private corporation, subsequent to this?
Oh, yeah, they reached an agreement either in late December or early January of this year on what happened, using very favorable terms.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Rogers. Mr. Newman, 30 seconds, unless someone asks you a question, I'll take your first 30 seconds. Mr. Newman.
It's not just Dr. Harrison's memo, it's also the questions and answers before the Board of Trustees, where the Board asks questions and answers them, and one of the answers was separating out hospital employees will make it more likely that the hospital can negotiate acceptable benefit packages with effective unions. That's it.
If there was a memorandum from the president or the director of the hospital to someone saying, I'd prefer to see our employees represented by Union A instead of Union B, would that be an anti-union animus?
Yes, I don't think that it is a prerogative of management to involve itself in a decision by employees as to which labor organization they choose to run.
Well, that may be true, but do you think that's what the General Assembly means when it says anti-union animus? Isn't the whole idea of collective bargaining to give employees rights to bargain and to bargain fairly, and that the state employers should not prevent that or impede it in some way versus the state being involved in which union is going to represent the employees? There is a difference, is there not, in terms of the impact of the conduct of the state or the public employer?
I don't think that the CERB or the state is free to select a union that it feels more comfortable with than one that is not. I think that's a violation of 41.11. I just want to say that the argument was made here that there can't be any violation of 41.17 because the university was discriminating against everybody, that everybody was terminated. I'm reminded of Anatole France's comment that the most perfect expression of the majestic equality of the law is that the rich and the poor both are prohibited from sleeping on the bridges. It's not, discrimination is their word. The word in Athena is anti-union animus. If there's anti-union animus expressed in the transaction, then that is an unfair labor practice. The fact of the matter is, discriminated though they may be, the management employees have fared very well, and the union employees in this case have not.
Thank you, Mr. Newman. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.